The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Cap Bailey. With me today is my co-host and news contributor, Nadia Oxford.
Hello, hello.
And also frequent contributor and also senior writer, Bob Mackey.
Hello, everybody.
We are got another week of RPG discussion, lots of discussion about the art genre that we love. And this week, we will be discussing God Eater, the
yes.
new Fallout 4 DLC, and our big one, Super NES RPGs in Perspective. We've
Yay.
Already talked about Dragon Quest. We've already talked about, oh God, what else have we talked about? There was a different one that we talked about.
Shadow Hearts.
We talked
Robo
about
Trek.
The Mana series.
Yes, that's right. That was one I rambled on about forever, and I enjoyed it very much. Thank you for listening.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's always it's always nice to be able to get you like really talking about something that you really like, Nadia. Because, like,
I think you
you're,
mean
like,
just...
super knowledge because you're super knowledgeable about the stuff that you love, and you just like bring so much insight to it. I love it.
I'm kind of crazy in that regard. Yeah, it was a lot of fun to just kind of let go and have a good time.
Indeed. So, this week is the big one. We're doing Final Fantasy, which God knows, like Final Fantasy 4, 5, and 6 on the Super Nintendo have been discussed enough, but I think that we can get some interesting perspectives.
Yes.
I think so.
Going right to the main topic of discussion, I've been playing the new Fallout 4 DLC, Nuka World, which is set in an amusement park, and you are working with some raider gangs, and effectively, it's your opportunity to be the bad guy. If you don't want to work with the Minutemen, the group led by Preston Garvey that is establishing settlements throughout the wasteland and just kind of trying to save everybody, you can instead betray them and join the raiders and go and take over settlements and start raiding camps and just be evil, which is really interesting.
Yeah, that sounds interesting, but that's the sort of gameplay that makes me very uncomfortable. It's not something I would be able to do personally.
No pillaging for you, Nadia?
I'm not much of a pillager. It's just not really my nature.
I'm more of a looter, so...
Yeah. I could do some quiet looting, but maybe. From someone who really deserves it.
I'm with you, Nadia, actually. I have a really hard time going, like, flat-out evil in a video game.
Mm-hmm.
I go, like, but I want everybody to be happy.
Yeah.
And whenever, like, I go full-on evil, like, I'm... Like, people get mad at me in the game, and, like, I'm burning things down, and quests that I might have been able to do go away, and usually the rewards aren't good enough when
yeah.
you're evil to justify being evil.
The last time I went full evil in a video game was Mega Man Legends 2 on the PlayStation, and
oh.
part of the reason I went evil is because when you kick animals, you turn evil, so that's obviously not something I would do in video games or in real life, but the thing is, when you kick the pigs, they bounce. So I got addicted to watching the pigs bounce. And then the best part of it all is that when Roll, your sister, like asks you, what's wrong with you, Mega Man? Why are you so evil? What's going on? Can you tell me? And Mega Man, like the dialogue options it gives you is, I'm very sorry, I'll try my best. And my favorite is, oh, leave me alone, you old biddy.
So evil.
So evil and bad. But yeah, I turned completely black, and you had to pay like $1 million to get better, and I never did make that money.
I think the problem with being evil in a lot of games is that when you go evil, like you go full-on chaotic evil,
mm-hmm.
and there's not enough, maybe like ends justify the means, like bog standard, you know, Republican evil.
Yeah.
Oh,
we hate
no.
everyone.
I apologize to the conservatives listening to this program. We are very accepting of all political ideologies.
They're also leaving the program.
They're leaving the program.
I just think of the episode of The Simpsons where it's like cuts to the Republican Party, like, and there's the lightning around the castle.
Yeah.
And you got the vampire drinking the blood and everything. But. the problem, yeah, and then oftentimes your character ends up being kind of ugly. Like, if you go Renegade in Mass Effect, not only, like, do you really screw yourself out of, like, anything good in Mass Effect,
mm-hmm.
you end up with these really ugly, like, scars and things that you have a hard time removing. I forget the You have to get like a special surgery, I think, in order to get rid of the scars that appear from you being evil, I guess.
I think that most games don't do it well. I would try to be evil more often, or at least experiment with it. But most of the time, being evil or being like amoral or whatever in a game will cut you off from content.
Yeah.
And if you want to play as much content in a game as you can possibly play, that's not a really good incentive. You know, people no longer will talk to you, will, you know, fight you upon seeing you, will no longer offer to give you things or ask you to do things. Like, I feel like that is the most common result of evil actions in a game with a morality system, which aren't as common as they used to be. I feel like last gen was the peak of morality systems, and Fallout's morality system is sort of just a holdover from that, almost.
Yeah, Kat. I was going to say, one of the strangest incidents of morality in an RPG that I can think of is actually a game I'm replaying. I'm replaying Illusion of Gaia for the SNES right now. And you probably know that there's these gem things that you have to collect. There's 50 of them, and you have to get every single one in order to get this particular reward. And there's one in particular you can only get by ratting out a slave in hiding.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, and there is no way around this. There is no ifs, ands, or buts. You either rat on this guy and the guy protecting the slave, or you don't get it. And it's a very, very uncomfortable moment in that game, out of many uncomfortable moments in that game.
I always thought that Mass Effect 1 did a good job of kind of balancing things out, because essentially you're either playing like an egalitarian, very into diversity, I want to work with all of the aliens kind of person, or you play much more of an Earth first, humans need to take their proper place among the stars kind of character.
Right.
And the choices that you're making, whether it's like, oh, you can opt to save this species that once rampaged across the galaxy because they seem really, really sorry, or you can let them die, or, you know, things, or like the big climactic choice, where, I'm sorry, spoilers for a 9-year-old game at this point, you can opt to save the console or let them die and allow humans to kind of ascend. And those are interesting choices, but a lot of that is undone or just doesn't show up very well in Mass Effect 2 or 3, which is really unfortunate. So, but in a vacuum, Mass Effect 1 did it pretty well, but Fallout 4, Nuka World, so far the DLC is just okay. I really like the environments. It's almost like Disney World. Like, it's divided into different areas. Like, so you have a, you know, like a space world and that kind of thing. And so there are fun themes. And one of the first things you do is you fight this enemy who has like this invincible power armor that's drawing from a power grid. So you have to shoot them with a literal water gun to be able to short it out and then go in and actually be able to damage them. So that's kind of fun.
Who's running Nuka World in the context of the game story?
Well, it's been taken over by 3 raider gangs. You have these people called the Pack who are dress up, who have taken over the zoo, and they dress up in like kind of animal paraphernalia. You have the operators who are just all in it for the money. And you have another group, and I think they're just about violence. They're kind of more the BDSM group, I suppose. And you can just opt to go and take over different areas of Nuka World by like clearing them out, reactivating them, and then you plant a flag and give it to the raider group of your choice. And if you just favor one raider group over the others will get pissed. So there's some politics going on there. But the problem with Nuka World right now is that it's like all fetch quests. And I'm in the process of clearing out one of the areas right now. And it's like get 30 star or get 20 star cores minimum. And it's like, oh, good. Grabbing, like finding stuff so that I can activate a power core. This is really exciting.
Finding stuff at the end of the world.
Yeah, it's not the most creative thing. And compared to Far Harbor, which was really, really, really good.
Yeah.
And gave you a lot of different options and had some like moral ambiguity. And was a lot more ambitious. Like, I think Nuka World so far falls a bit short. I think the plus side is that if you really want to role play a different type of character, You can take the Raiders out of Nuke World and like have them be the anti-Minutemen, which is kind of fun. You get a lot of new settlement stuff. You get a lot more weapons. And if you're just really enjoying Fallout 4, which I ended up enjoying Fallout 4 a lot, it's more Fallout 4.
So. Yeah, I guess that's a good pitch for it. It's more Fallout 4.
So you can read my review next week, or not next week, tomorrow. And you can also find, I'll round up the DLC and like do a final evaluation, because this is it. This is the end of Fallout 4.
Yeah, that's pretty much the end of it.
Yeah, that's done.
We'll see another one.
Kind of a disappointing finale, but what are you going to do?
Yeah, it sounds like it should have been reversed in terms of the DLC.
I'm sure we'll see another one by 2022. We'll see Fallout 5.
I kind of want them to put it in space or something. That would be fun, but that would be probably contrary to the theme of the series.
Is that part of the canon? Is that part of the canon?
Well, here's the thing. When you're in the space area, there's an exhibit by Vault-Tec, and they're like, we are like working on the future and of sending humans into space. And this will be like what your space home will be like and stuff like that. Very much like future world in Disney World. And so I'm like going, or Tomorrowland, sorry. And so I'm kind of going, oh, well, that would be kind of fun if like Vault-Tec actually did establish a colony elsewhere or something. And so you're on another planet. Maybe you can go to different planets. I'm obsessed with this idea of colonizing other planets.
I'm actually thinking like Vault-Tec, their whole thing is twisted vault experiments. What if they put a vault on the moon and they didn't even know they were on the moon? Yeah, you could go places with it.
If you want to make the game more exciting, you can pretend that No Man's Sky is secretly Fallout 5.
I wish I could, but
if you haven't returned
No Man's
it yet,
Sky is not nearly that interesting. So,
no twisted vault experiments in No Man's Sky.
Bob, you were playing God Eater recently. You put a review on the site. I was wondering if you could share your thoughts on it.
Sure. Well, it wasn't really a review because it is like a 100-plus-hour game, but I've only played all these Monster Hunter clones sort of like after the fact. I did play through Peace Walker, which isn't totally a Monster Hunter clone, but it does really borrow from Monster Hunter, which of course is Capcom's long-running handheld RPG series about fighting monsters. And there's a lot more to it than that, but that's basically the premise. But it's been weird to go back to these clones now that I realize so many of them exist after playing the real thing and being not at all surprised that there is nothing like just playing Monster Hunter, because there's just so much time and so much invested in those games and that series and just so much refined over the past decade that it's hard for a developer working with not a lot of money to make something similar that isn't disappointing. And that's really what God Eater is. It's just basically your bog standard Monster Hunter clone with more of an anime flair to it. But at the same time, for as close as it is to Monster Hunter, that just makes it, you just completely compare it in every way, which may be a little unfair. But again, they are trying to be that. But that thing is already in existence. So I'm not sure why this game should exist or what justifies it being around or justifies anyone really spending time with it. I don't know if you folks have ever played any Monster Hunter clones or anything like that, or even Monster Hunter.
I mean, I've played Monster Hunter, but I have not played a lot of Monster Hunter clones. I played back like 5 years ago or something on the PSP. There was a Monster Hunter clone from Square Enix called like Arcane something.
Oh, I remember that.
There's been so many. There's like Soul Sacrifice and Freedom Wars, and just over time, they mostly started at the turn of the last decade. That's when Monster Hunter was really at its hottest, before like mobile games completely took over Japan and everyone was playing it on PSP. But a lot of these started in the late aughts and early teens, these Monster Hunter clones, and they're still continuing apparently.
Yeah.
I mean, there was I played Final Fantasy Monster Hunter clone earlier this year, and it was okay.
Yeah.
It wasn't amazing.
Oh, I forgot about Final Fantasy Explorers. That's part of it too. Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
But again, it sucks that I can't remove Monster Hunter from my brain in order to properly in quotes evaluate this game. If I want to dip into like some high level stuff here, unfortunately, all things are defined by their relationships to other things, and I point that out in my write up. Like, this game exists in a reality with Monster Hunter, so with everything I see, I just can't help thinking that's better in Monster Hunter, that's better in Monster Hunter. And I streamed it, and my stream is just a constant stream of my stream is a stream of comparisons to Monster Hunter, where I say, like, take a drink every time I say Monster Hunter and you will die, because I probably said it at least 500 times to the point where the words Monster Hunter lost all meaning. But just playing it on the stream, I'm like, this just feels kind of cheap and floaty, and the animations aren't great, and the design is just kind of tacky and garish with none of the nuance or the kind of humor of Monster Hunter. And then, like, later that day, which I think was yesterday, I jumped back into Monster Hunter again, and I was like immediately like, wow, even on a 3DS screen, there is so much more detail. Everything is much more visually interesting. There's so much nuance to the animation. Like, my character's weight will slightly shift if I'm on a slight incline, and just everything moves so much better. I mean, just it's pretty astonishing just how much better and different the real thing is compared to what is trying to copy it. And, you know, Soul Eater could have Soul Eater. What is it called again? Wait, what's this game called? God Eater. God Eater. Soul Burst. God Eater 2 Soul Burst? I don't know what its name is. God Eater 2, let's just say that. I think it probably could have done better if it didn't try to copy Monster Hunter so specifically, because even certain things down to like the button placements are the same.
Wow.
Well, didn't you say that Monster Hunter was, or God Eater was basically Monster Hunter with waifus?
Pretty much, yes. I mean, like, it is for the, like, the horned up teen demographic, which many Vita games are for. I started on the PSP, of course, but it's like, oh, the first character you meet is a cat girl with significant underboob. So it's like, oh, that's my first character. I'm not going to listen to this story anymore because I don't care. It's just like, yeah, they try to use those sort of those titillating elements to pave over the problems with the game. And my recommendation is, like, if you want to try out Monster Hunter but you don't have a PC, and there's no reason why Monster Hunter shouldn't be a PC game, like, Capcom is really missing out by not putting it on different platforms, in my opinion.
PC Master Race alert.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I know who's going to comment on this, buddy, and I've got your number. But listen to me. I feel like if you want to kind of get a taste for what Monster Hunter is, you might want to try things like Tokiden, which is also on Steam, which I think is also an okay clone, but it's much better than this. But if you just kind of want to get a taste of what Monster Hunter is and sort of how it plays, this could be fun to check out. Unfortunately, it is $50, so you might want to wait. But yeah, I feel like, again, it's trying to be Monster Hunter, but Monster Hunter already exists. It's like, in my article, I was like, it's kind of like taking a swig of like soda and then realizing it's not the Coca-Cola you ordered. It's like store brand. It's like, essentially, that's the comparison. It's like the store brand soda to Monster Hunter's Coca-Cola. Like, it's trying to do what it can. It doesn't have the money or the talent or the marketing or the like artistry behind it to make it that good. So it can only be like leave a kind of bad aftertaste in your mouth. So yeah, I want to see more clones of Monster Hunter. I want to see more people do different things with the idea, but God Eater. I keep forgetting the name. God Eater just is like, oh, we could do that, and we don't have enough money, and we don't have a lot of the same talent, so I guess we'll just do it not as well. Like, I would have preferred they tried something slightly different than just Monster Hunter without the nuance, and that's essentially what it is. And I'm sure if you guys have any questions or if you care that much, but it is interesting to see this game pop up on Steam, because we did not get the original sequel. This is like the enhanced version of God Eater 2, which appeared on the PS Vita in 2013. And I think it's pretty funny that this game was originally localized as God's Eater, which I guess is more technically correct because you're fighting these dark gods. But I think that localization change happened because it's like, we don't want to piss off like monotheists, but we can throw a polytheist under the bus, because I mean, that's sort of the case with everything. It's like, you can't summon Jesus in Final Fantasy, but you can summon Shiva, because no one believes in that anymore, but actually a lot of people do. So just a little funny anecdote.
1.2 billion of us.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, that's super.
That Simpson scene does really say a lot. But
God Eater, though, I remember when it came out, and it was billed as the kind of more anime, faster-paced alternative to Monster Hunter. Because, let's face it, Monster Hunter is kind of an acquired taste, and there are plenty of people who are looking for a more traditionally anime kind of approach to the series, and I think that's valid.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and I think it's valid to want something that's more along the lines of, like, Devil May Cry or whatever, with the animations and the fast pace and the nuanced combos and everything. And that's fine, too. I think where, like, we kind of part ways with God Eater is when you're talking about, like, it's floaty, it's not very satisfying, like, and then you go, ooh, because a lot of what makes Monster Hunter so satisfying is that every blow counts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, every and you can really, counts, you can, like, feel it. You, like, it's satisfying because the animation plays out so well and it's so specific, and just the intentionality behind every movement in that game is what makes it satisfying.
And it's too bad that it's not, it doesn't sound like it's particularly good, because it would have been an interesting test case if it ended up, like, was just as good as Monster Hunter, but had mostly flown under the radar because it was on, like, handheld systems and weren't super popular here, and then ended up being on, like, the PC. And wasn't there one on PS4 as well? I think there was.
This is also a PS4 game.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, like, having it on, like, mainstream consoles, like, it would have been interesting to be able to see, like, how well it would have ended up doing. And instead, it feels a little bit like off-brand Monster Hunter with anime characters, which
pretty
is,
much.
Yeah.
And in my write-up, I made the comparison. It's sort of like, kind of like Monster Hunter meets Dynasty Warriors, minus the, you know, sheer amount of enemies you're fighting. I feel it has, like, the same kind of artless, button-mashy combat, which can be fine. Like, I enjoy Dragon Quest Heroes, but again, that was a much better-made game than this. And mixing that kind of button-mashy, artless combat with the fighting a monster for 10 to 15 minutes style of Monster Hunter just doesn't feel satisfying to me. It just kind of feels like I'm just chipping away at something in a very boring manner with, like, no artistry behind it, no strategy, no planning, and it is kind of unsatisfying.
Well, some people like that kind of gameplay, so maybe they're, like, quietly taking notes and thinking
that is true.
Oh, I'm gonna play this game now. So
if you're interested, I would wait, though. I mean, this is a $50 game and it's destined to go down in price soon. I can tell. So I don't know why you would want to play it after me saying all this stuff about it, but if you're still interested, go for it. I would also recommend, I would rather you play Tokiden, which is a another Monster Hunter clone by Tecmo Koei. But it's all about fighting, like, Japanese mythological creatures, which are, the game looks really cool. Like, it's against a faster paced Monster Hunter, but I think the combat feels better. The designs are more interesting. It's much, much prettier to look at. God Eater is kind of an ugly game. Like, it feels like a real early last gen game. Everything is, like, gray and green and brown. Just, like, a lot of really gross colors mixed together. I don't know what they are going for, but it just it feels like the kind of teenage anime, like, this is so dark and angsty, like that kind of effect. And I don't think I'm in the God Eater audience, honestly. If you look at the characters, you look at the cutscenes and things like that, this is not made for me. But at the same time, I'm asked to write my opinions about it, and I don't like it that much.
Has there actually been a good, like, a really good, high-quality Monster Hunter clone? Like, I can think of some that were fairly well-received, like Soul Sacrifice.
People say, Soul Sacrifice. I hear, like, a lot of really, really good things about that game. And apparently it's different enough from Monster Hunter to avoid having people make the constant comparisons to what is probably a better experience. The fact that it does its own thing makes me interested in knowing what that is. But I think that might be the most, like, critically successful Monster Hunter clone. I can't think of another one that might have done better or got more buzz than Soul Sacrifice. And I think that even had, like, Inafune's name stamped on it. I'm not sure how much he did with it or if he was a huge part of it. But I remember he was part of the marketing for it. I guess back when his name was meant quality, unlike now, I guess, which is a little bit different. Yeah, he was the designer on this game, so his name has kind of got a black spot on it now. Hopefully that'll go away soon. But back then, hey, let's tell people the Mega Man guy made this.
Okay, time to move on to the next segment, which is the Super NES in Perspective series that we've been working on. As I already mentioned, we already did Dragon Quest and we did Seiken Densetsu, but it's time to move on to the big one. It's time to move on to Final Fantasy, which of course, I wouldn't say that it came into its own on the Super Nintendo because, I mean, the original Final Fantasy was actually fairly popular in the US in a way that the original Dragon Warrior was not.
Yeah.
And of course, it famously saved Square back in the day. So, like, Final Fantasy was certainly well established, but I think a lot of people would say that the series.
I do want to say, Kat,
kind of owned the Super Nintendo.
That Final Fantasy story is apocryphal. It's one of many stories.
I heard like, that it's false advertising. This isn't final at all.
Yeah. But
the Final Fantasy.
That is also like the Final Fantasy thing. I think it was going to be Sakaguchi's last game. I think really what it was though was they wanted something with two F's in English to be like catchy, since it's sort of like a catchy device in Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is where it came from. And it was going to be called Fighting Fantasy, but that was a trademark term. So we can all just calm down. We can all just calm down about that final part because that was never intended initially.
I didn't realize the whole Fighting Fantasy because I was into Fighting Fantasy too. But
Wow, okay.
That would have been
trademarked. Yeah. I didn't want to be one of those well actually guys, but I feel like that story gets tossed around a lot, but I feel like there are many stories, and I don't know if any of them have actually been confirmed outside of the Fighting Fantasy part.
No, but it makes sense, especially since the Dragon Quest series was Dragon Warrior here because of TSR. They had a Dragon Quest module.
Yeah, they really liked a lot of English trademark terms that had already been trademarked, I guess.
Yeah, but they waited them out, I guess.
Could you imagine the people who would like go Fighting Fantasy? That sounds exciting and cool and full of swords and sorcery and like high action, and then bought it and got a menu-based RPG.
Yeah, I think Final Fantasy is far more suited for the gameplay,
because those were the days where you would literally go to a store and look at the boxes and go, well, that kind of looks kind of interesting, can I see that one? Oh, the screenshots look legit, okay, I think I'll buy it.
Yep.
it didn't necessarily say this is a turn-based RPG. If you're expecting like action, you may be in trouble.
Yeah, and they usually use like really specific buzzwords like on the back of the box. Like they would probably say Final Fantasy, oh, it was exciting and adventure, and it is, but it is very much a game that unfurls on its own time.
But Final Fantasy 2 and 3 on the NES did not make it here for whatever reason. I forget what the exact reason was.
I think it's because way too late to the party. Like, we got Final Fantasy 1 3 years after it was out in Japan.
Yeah, 90, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was 87 in Japan, 90 here. And by the next year, we would have the SNES, so there'd be no reason to localize two games for a system they kind of wanted to put behind them.
I hear that
too
was actually almost fully localized.
That is true.
The way, Earthbound Zero was.
It was advertised, I think, maybe like in a trade ad for like Square's upcoming lineup.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if that localization ever came into being or if that was like dumped from a ROM or something. But man, I should have came prepared for this. But yeah, you're right, Nadia. That was like almost a possibility. But I'm glad it didn't happen because then no one would like Final Fantasy in America anymore. Two is not the best moment for that series. I mean, it has its interesting ideas, but God, find me someone who likes two Japanese and has finished it, and I'll give you a cookie.
I guarantee
that there's somebody out there and that they probably listen to this podcast.
That person has to be listening to this podcast right now.
So if you like Final Fantasy II for the NES, come out, write us a letter, and Bob will send you a cookie.
And I will say, I make an honest attempt to play that game every time it's re-released, but I get like 3 hours in and I say, just what am I doing? What is even happening
in
my life?
Yeah, it's never been. I'll be honest with you, the original Final Fantasy is not my favorite game. I've never finished it in any.
This is off topic, but I mean, the Dawn of Souls one is probably the best, easiest one to do. Just
because it gets rid of
all the grindiness.
That one, I didn't finish.
Okay.
I just found it a little too tedious.
Yeah, I liked the Dawn of Souls Final Fantasy quite a bit. That was the one that I ended up finishing. It was more attractive than the NES game, obviously, and it had a pretty good soundtrack. And
wasn't buggy.
At the time, I was spending an extended amount of time in the hospital, so
I
had a lot of time to just sit around and play Final Fantasy. So
it's actually funny that since we're going into Final Fantasy 2 SNES/4, I actually played that one in the summer that I had major surgery, so that was a good accompaniment for that.
In any case, Final Fantasy IV made it out here in the U.S. in 1991, just a few months after it came out in Japan. Mm-hmm. It was July 1991 in Japan and November 1991 here in the U.S., which puts it just a couple months after the launch of the Super Nintendo. And it was interesting because when it came out on the Super Nintendo, it wasn't that attractive. Like, it was a step up from your average NES game. But I imagine that for a lot of people, the two things that would jump out would be how big the monster sprites were.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the music.
Yes.
Because, oh my god, like, even in
the music was the biggest step up, yeah.
Even in 1999, which was the first year that I played Final Fantasy II, like, that sound, that music really jumped out at me, especially the boss theme. Like,
I love that boss theme.
It wasn't that complicated, but it was fast and fun and cool and really put you in the mood to, like, get into a big boss fight.
Yeah, I still love that. And also, the theme that always stands out to me is the surface theme for the moon. It's a very creepy, sort of unusual music that you don't hear that often from any sort of RPG by any composer. It's very unusual.
The other thing that stood out to a lot of people about Final Fantasy IV was that compared to a lot of the games at that time, it had a really complicated story.
It did, for its time.
And for those who did not play PC RPGs in, like, the 80s and early 90s here in the US, like, this was their first real taste of, like, a hardcore RPG story.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was overwrought. Let's be honest. Like, there are a lot of people dying and then come back into life.
Yeah,
but it is easy to follow, which would not be the case for every Final Fantasy game.
That is true. It is a very traditional, very easy to follow story.
It's a very fairy tale kind of story. I mean, it is very anime too, but I feel like it is just very, like, very easy to follow beats. You know why everybody's doing what they're doing. You know what everyone's motivation is. Everyone has their own story. It's very straightforward, and I think the series lost that a bit in the following decade.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting is that the character of Cecil was not your typical Final Fantasy protagonist, right?
Yeah.
He was a dark knight, he was older, he was married, and he was on a quest of redemption. And
yeah,
he wasn't angsty precisely, but he knew that he had committed, like, terrible crimes.
Actually, one of my favorite things about replaying Final Fantasy IV, and one of the reasons I go back to it, is just that whole arc of redemption that Cecil goes through when he lands on the beach after everyone, all his friends he figures are dead because he thinks they were killed by Leviathan. He's alone. He has to go back to Mysidia, and that's where he has to basically redeem himself for everything he's done, because he basically killed a whole bunch of people.
I think he's pretty angsty, though, but in a tolerable way. Like, in the beginning of the game, before you go to Mist, and he's in his bed sleeping in his full armor, of course, Rosa comes up to talk to him, and he does seem incredibly angsty, I think. I feel like he's very conflicted, but they don't have a lot of text to spend in these old games, so you're not just reading paragraphs upon paragraphs of this guy, like, whining about his life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course, Final Fantasy II here in the U.S. Was infamously Final Fantasy IV easy type.
That's wrong.
No?
Wrong.
Yeah, Bob's got the right of it. It was...
Yeah,
it
this
had
has been a misconception.
Elements.
Yeah, this has been a misconception that I think everybody was under for a long time. And I wish I'd looked this up ahead of time, but easy type was a version of the game later released in Japan that's actually easier than the American version. The American version was made easier in some cases, mm-hmm. but I believe Easy Type is an even easier version.
It is.
Based on the American version, but only released in Japan. So they did change things for us, like dummying out certain skills and making, I believe, just there's just one healing item instead of there being a bunch of them. But yeah, Easy Type is a different beast altogether. I'm sorry for correcting you so much on this, Kat.
No, don't worry about it.
Use like a post to make my voice sound less condescending. I'm a true gamer boy. with all the facts.
Well, Final Fantasy II certainly picked up a lot of fans. It didn't necessarily like revolutionize RPGs here in the US. Like, RPGs are still seen as a really niche genre on consoles, but is it fair to say that Final Fantasy was the most popular console RPG at that time?
I would think so.
Yeah, it would have to be, really.
I mean, Phantasy Star was a distant second on the Genesis.
Yeah, well, the Genesis was like certainly rising at that time, but I don't think a lot of people, and Phantasy Star was a part of it, but it wasn't. Yeah, I would say that Phantasy Star was probably a distant second, but a very good second, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
It was a very good game. Yeah.
I found that, like, okay, so I played Final Fantasy I, didn't quite get it. My stepdad at the time, who was my new stepdad, and now my current stepdad, he was way into RPGs, a huge nerd. He did tabletop gaming and stuff like that, and he would be playing a lot of video game RPGs, and they were sort of new to me, so I would watch him play them and try to figure them out. And this is the one that, like, he would come home from work every day and play a little bit more, and I would watch him. I would just be so enthralled by the story and, like, all the crazy monsters and things like that. And I watched him finish the game, and that's when I decided that I needed to play it, and that's sort of what kicked off my RPG love in, like, 1991 or 92. Just... Aww. This game alone, and I did have Dragon Warrior 2 before that. I did play Final Fantasy, but I don't think my brain was developed enough. I was like, I'm just too stupid for these games. But I think by age 9, I was totally ready for Final Fantasy 2/4 and like RPGs for the rest of the decade.
Well, Final Fantasy 5 was possibly going to come out here. There was word of a game called Final Fantasy Extreme, which would have been Final Fantasy V.
That was going to be a later PC port, I believe. That was what the Extreme was.
Okay.
Yeah.
I had always heard that Final Fantasy V might have come out here.
That's strike three, Kat. This is my podcast now.
You're fired.
But it never did come out here and was...
We got Baby Quest.
And it was for quite a while. It was the... kind of the holy grail. Like, it was like, if you were hardcore, if you got a ROM and the translation patch for Final Fantasy V, or
yes,
read the FAQ, like Chris Kohler got to start writing FAQs, and Final Fantasy V was one of the first ones he did.
That was probably not, I don't think that was the first ROM hack translation, but it was like the first super notable one,
yeah,
of a game,
absolutely,
everyone wanted to play. And I downloaded it like probably that first day or week or whatever. And I was like, this is literally magic. I'm playing an unreleased Final Fantasy game in like 97 maybe or 98.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh my God, how is this even possible? I'm sure it was translated very poorly, but it was still playable.
I think 5 had a pretty good translation. A lot of those early games, actually, I think... Clyde Tomato had a hand in them.
Okay.
I'm not sure if he did.
Yeah. I think 5 was for some group like Shadow Translate. They all have really embarrassing names because they were all teenagers in the 90s, but
yeah.
I think those people just did that and then disappeared.
Yeah, but the really bad translations, I think those usually belong to DJAP.
Yes, the very classy name DJAP. Yeah. Please don't isolate me saying the second half of that word.
It's for historical purposes.
Yes, we all know that Arch fucks like a tiger and William Shatner references and so on. That's like the classic DJAP touch.
Yep.
They're their own working designs in a way.
But they did their Final Fantasy IV retranslation, and everyone thought that was like the authentic thing, that
yes,
Nintendo had like censored everything, and like Cecil was saying the F word every 2 seconds or whatever.
It is like watching old Dragon Ball Z like fan subs, or
yes,
Goku's always just going shit.
But I actually,
well, this was the period when Final Fantasy VII had come out, and everybody was like, "Oh my god, look how much edgier Sony is!"
Because god damn, that's
saying
edgy.
Damn.
But
did he say shit at one point?
He says damn shit and like a bunch of symbol signs because they weren't on the same page. Yeah, like sometimes he'll swear and it'll be just censored out. Like, no one knew what the other localizer was doing.
Yeah.
Like, can we swear? Can we not swear? Does this guy talk with a southern accent? Who knows?
But I actually Final Fantasy IV translation. When it came out, I was actually working at Canada's Wonderland, which is like an amusement park, and I was a guess you'd call me a barf mopper, and I had a supervisor who was kind of a jerk, but he's also a big nerd, so I got out of a lot of work by just basically staying near him and telling him all about this cut content from Final Fantasy IV.
That's actually a really touching story now. Connecting through Final Fantasy IV, I have a similar story in that I think I talked about on this podcast and several others. Like, I went to, I grew up in a world without nerds. I was like the nerdiest person I knew. No one could come close to like identifying with me or being into anything I liked. So I was just very lonely. Aww. But I met people in college at some anime night, of course. Where else would you meet people in college? But we spent the first night like reminiscing over Spoony Bards and things like that. So aww. Like, I met my best friends still today just talking about Final Fantasy IV and some of its more sillier parts.
That's awesome. Aww. I like that sort of thing. But no,
I did not play Final Fantasy IV until I got a Super Nintendo in 1999. And I was working at a KFC at the time. And our assistant manager, who, interesting guy, lived in his parents' attic and probably, I think, smoked a lot of weed. But to me, he was like, oh my God, you are so cool because you have all of the video games and you're older and you can drink and stuff.
That's nice. What I'm aspiring to, Kat. Don't be so judgmental.
But he loaned me Final Fantasy IV.
Oh, that was nice of him.
That was the first time I got to play it. But I had already played Final Fantasy VI.
Yeah, see, I played IV after VI.
So I was like, oh, wow, this looks a lot worse than Final Fantasy VI. And I actually played it for a while, but then the battery, like, died on me. And wow. My save got erased. So it was many moons before I finally beat it.
I played them in order, and I played 5 after 6 and probably after 7, but 4 is probably the RPG I finished the most, mainly mm-hmm. because it's really easy to follow. It is maybe 20 to 25 hours, probably not even that, if you know what you're doing. And there's not a whole lot of grinding. The game is very well designed in that it knows what abilities you'll have for the things you're facing.
Yeah.
So like the bosses are kind of like puzzles. Like the developers know what you're able to do, what your capabilities are, what your limits are, and everything is designed for that kind of linear character growth.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of the moon, I have to say fuck the moon. It's way too hard. But
I love the moon.
The moon on the DS version is when that's the one version of the game I haven't finished because
yeah,
the moon.
The DS version, they made it way too hard.
A lot of huge difficulty spikes. The battles are a lot slower because they're animating kind of cruddy DS polygons. I do love the voice acting in the DS version. It was really a treat to hear all those scenes voice acted.
Yes.
And really melodramatic. It really brings out the melodrama when you're having voice actors act out Final Fantasy IV dialogue.
Oh, I adore it.
Yeah, and I kind of, I mean, as cruddy as the polygons are, I sort of like the 3D designs,
mm-hmm.
but yeah, the difficulty spikes are weird in that port.
Yeah, they really are. I would definitely say, there's people who say to me, I've never played Final Fantasy IV DS, I've never played Final Fantasy IV, should I start with the one on the DS? And I always say, no, do not start with that one. That is a game for people who are really huge nerds about Final Fantasy IV and know every in and out and want to really challenge themselves on a stupid, stupid level.
Yes, that's true. I couldn't make the cut.
The PSP one's still the best.
PSP one is fantastic.
Yeah.
100%
Final Fantasy V did not come out here, but a Final Fantasy did come out here. It's called Final Fantasy Mystic Quest.
I never played that one. I mean, I have played it, but I can't say I've gotten very far in it.
Notoriously easy.
Great music.
But good music.
Really good music. It has that great poorly aged SNES sort of like fake electric guitar.
Yes, God bless.
Which pops up a lot.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Like a real Mega Man Legends, Mega Man X Super Punch Out, like yeah,
wailing guitar.
It sounds like a muted duck or something. But,
a little wah wah sort of sound.
Yeah, it's a very muted guitar sound, but yeah, a lot of the music is like that. A lot of it, like the boss battle theme, is really cool. And I played through, and it was fun. It plays more like Final Fantasy meets like sort of like a board game style setup.
Mm-hmm.
It does feel kind of patronizing, like, oh, you Americans, you're too stupid.
The fact they called it Final Fantasy USA in Japan is just like,
yeah,
you tug your collar moment.
Well, that was what we deserved. We still didn't like RPGs at that time, so.
Yeah, that's true.
They're like, well, maybe if we can get people who are feeling intimidated by RPGs into something easy, then like they can get a foothold in the kind of the genre, and then we can like feed them more advanced fare.
Yeah, but nobody bought it
anyway. And I'm sure that Nintendo had something to do with that. This is like, that could have been try number three or four for RPG to take off in America, which wouldn't happen really until, for them, Pokemon.
Yeah.
Well, for them, yeah.
Yeah.
RPGs had already taken off the year before.
Yeah, yeah.
But of course, is it fair to say that maybe the Super Nintendo among RPG enthusiasts best remembered for Final Fantasy VI or Chrono Trigger?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, 100%.
Six and Chrono Trigger. I mean, Chrono Trigger, I love Six to death. I have a really intense personal connection with it, but I think Chrono Trigger is sort of like the platonic ideal of the 16-bit RPG experience.
Yes.
It feels like very complete and thorough, and every element of it is very, everything about it is very thoughtful. I can't feel like there's any weak spots in that game. It's like a 20-hour RPG, which is just ideal for me, and I can play that game over and over and over, which is, it's designed to be played over and over, so
yeah,
that helps.
I've played it several times over, but I remember it was such an innocent time when I actually had the internet by the time Chrono Trigger was a thing. Through my school, we had an internet connection, and there were people on these like online text BBSs arguing about how, you know, Final Fantasy VI was so much better than Chrono Trigger, and Square Enix was really slipping with Chrono Trigger. So, just in case you think anything
is
new under the sun,
so freaking stupid.
There is nothing new under
the
sun.
The 90s.
Yep.
So Final Fantasy VI, as I've said many times on this podcast, my first real introduction to the series, Final Fantasy Legend does not count, and I was like really blown away by it.
Oh yeah.
This was 1999, 2000. I was blown away by the melodrama of the story, the huge cast, the beautiful graphics, which are still beautiful even today.
Yeah.
The soundtrack, just on and on and on. Like, it worked on so many different levels. And people are like, whenever people want to say, well, the cast like kind of undoes it because you don't get to go as in depth into certain characters as you would want. I don't know.
I agree with that.
Having such a giant cast is just a lot of fun because you can pick the characters that you like.
Yeah, and
you don't have to worry as much about their skills and that kind of thing. And almost everybody gets at least one side quest.
Well, it's like, how in depth do you have to go with Umaro? He's a Sasquatch that squashes things.
Yeah.
That's all you really need.
He is the joke character, really, outside of
Go-Go.
The mime? Go-Go, yeah.
It's actually kind of funny how Go-Go, we all like philosophize that she was maybe Daryl, Setzer's girlfriend, and we had no idea that it was a character from Final Fantasy V. Go-Go
was
basically a joke character. So we had no idea, but we're making up all these crazy-ass theories for how Go-Go came to be, and it was pretty standard.
Go-Go fell through, like, a portal and ended up in the next game. Isn't that what happened?
That is exactly what happened.
Yeah.
That is exactly it.
Wasn't there a glitch that you could use to basically kill bosses at will?
The X-Zone.
You could turn them invisible and use X-Zone.
Oh, yeah, Vanish and then X-Zone. That is your key to success, at least in the early versions of the game. And maybe only the SNES version, they fixed that problem. But, like, basically any boss you could vanish, you could kill in one hit with X-Zone. And I did that in with Cyan, or Cayenne,
Rexel,
or whatever you say his name. Yeah,
Rexel,
that really hard boss.
So.
And God help me, I don't think I've ever finished it legitimately outside of Vanish X Zone. That's probably the one time I needed that.
I have. That was actually one of the sticking points for Final Fantasy VI for me. When I was my first playthrough, I put in like 60 hours and I was like, okay, I'm going to kick Kefka's ass. I'm just going to build up this party, this loser party. And I went to Doma to level up for some stupid reason. I went to sleep in the inn and I had Cyan in my party. Next thing I know, I'm trapped in this fucked up dream world and I can't get out and I don't have any good espers. I don't have anything. I can't leave. And I have this awful, awful boss who I don't know how to really kill properly because it's some stupid gimmick where you have to kill your own party members. And I had no idea that, you know, about the Vanish X-Zone trick at the time. So, man, did I ever get...
Yeah, God help you if you save your game in there without knowing what you're in for.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Final Fantasy VI, as much as I love it, it has major flaws in that regard. Like, you have to level up party members one at a time, or else they don't level up at all. And if someone has an Esper stuck on them and you're stuck in some idiot dream world, good luck, because you're not getting that Esper back.
Yeah, I forgot about that. I think we miss one of the bigger points of this game is that, I mean, spoilers, of course, I don't think this matters anymore in like 22 years later, but the fact that the world ends in this game and it kind of fakes you out, like, I was stuck on the first Kefka dungeon, the pre-World of Ruin dungeon, my first time in the game. I think I was like stuck on it for a week.
Yeah, that was a hard.
I don't know what it was, the boss, and maybe it was just too hard. So I picked up a guide and I was like, okay, I'll just use this guide to help me beat the boss. And I did. And I was like, oh man, that was the end of the game. That was pretty short, but I liked it. And then boom, like second part of the game, holy crap. I didn't even know how I could have gotten that free poster with the game that has the World of Ruin on it and thought like, what does this even mean? Like, I didn't even think about that. I will never be that surprised by a game again. That's like the greatest thrill of my gaming like experiences, is just realizing there was another part of Final Fantasy VI left to play, like an entire new game almost.
The thing with Final Fantasy VI too, if you want to talk about its relevance, is it had some very interesting themes that were very mature, not in the oh my god boobies way, but it was a very well-developed game story-wise, because yeah, you had the world ending. And he just has some really surprising themes. Like, one I brought up before is there is teen pregnancy in this game. And it's not really used as, like, a, you know, oh my god, edgy thing on its own. It's the fact of the matter is you have this very young couple in a world that is dying, and one of them finds out they're pregnant. And it's like, they're like, what the hell do we do? What is the point? And the whole point is, well, it's Terra who learns, okay, there is a point. There is a point to saving the world. There is a point to defeating Kefka. So it was just kind of, even going back to it now, I think that's a really well-told part of the story.
It's pretty amazing that content made it into the game, you know, untouched. I'm sure it might have been a little more saucy or edgy in Japanese.
They kind of softened it a bit. They were married in the U.S. version, ha ha ha, sure.
Oh, right. But they had a proper Christian marriage.
Yeah, in the yes. After the world ended. But,
yeah, there's also the suicide scene, and you know, like that does seem pretty extreme for an SNES game in 94, because it's not just like a samurai like sticking his sword through himself after he loses a battle. It's like a deliberately planned suicide with a note and everything, like a character being like, well, this is the day I'm gonna die, time to jump off a cliff.
Yeah,
and this is it.
And it's not like she doesn't have reason to kill herself, because everything she knows, or she thinks everything she knows, is gone and dead. And this is, she's stuck on this horrible island where you actually have, I don't know if you've noticed, but when you fight the enemies on that one solitary island, they're all poisoned. They all die immediately as soon as you
that's
you
right. Yeah,
them.
I forgot
so
about that.
Very,
that's a
very bleak moment.
That's a really cool touch that the mechanics add to the narrative. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
I was really depressed when I was on that island. I was like, everybody's dead.
That was a very depressing moment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it was dark and
I love
Sid died because I gave him the poison fish.
That stupid fish.
I'm a bad friend.
I love the music too. I think it's called Dark
the
World.
The music swelled. I was like, "Oh my god!"
Yeah, it's just the music that plays when Celeste is wandering, looking for her first few friends. Like, it's just it still gets me.
Just like, is it just like the wind blowing and like this organ dirge coming in?
Yeah. It's just
I felt guilty because I let Shadow die because I didn't wait for
him. I did that too, don't worry.
Yeah, I did the
so
first
did
time, yeah.
Yeah.
It's really unclear. Yeah, it's like, should we wait? He'll come in the last like 5 seconds, I think.
Yeah, and it's like, yeah, after going through that dungeon, because like Bob said, it's stupid hard, especially if you're not familiar with RPGs at the time, like I wasn't. I was like, yeah, like I'm gonna, like, there's the airship, yep, so long, I'm taking a leap. Goodbye. Sucks to be Shadow, but he wanted to die anyway, I guess.
Yeah.
R.I.P. Shadow. But
rip
so
in peace.
I wanted to be all devil's advocate and be like, yeah, well, maybe the series actually peaked with the PlayStation versions of Final Fantasy. But man, when like sitting here talking about the Super NES versions, I don't know that I can credibly make that argument. So I don't know.
It's hard to say, because just by terms of the sheer technology these games are running on, the SNES games can't help but age way, way, way better than even like things like not Final Fantasy IX, which is a pretty good-looking PlayStation 1 game, but then again, it is a good-looking PlayStation 1 game, which is not that good-looking to begin with.
Yeah.
In terms arguably, of just, like, yeah.
There are no, like, weak points, right? I mean, even arguably the weakest of the Super Nintendo ones, mainline Super Nintendo ones, not, sorry, Mystic Quest, you don't get to count in this regard.
Aww.
Final Fantasy V, like, is still very well regarded by fans.
Yes.
And
yeah.
Everybody I'd say jumps in and does the fiesta, the four job fiesta and everything. So
the one downside to five, which I don't consider a downside, but like there's no characters anybody cares about or likes.
Yeah.
Just like and for a while the main character was known as Butts.
Yes. I was about to say.
Because yeah. I believe in Japan it's like Batsu.
Yeah.
So they smartly changed his name to Barts, but I believe in the Barts is also stupid. Barts.
It is.
But I believe in the original Shadow translation of Final Fantasy V, his name is spelled B-U-T-Z.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, I guess that's the hero I'm stuck with, but this is Final Fantasy V, so it's butts time.
Well, yeah, this is the hand I've been dealt.
Final Fantasy V was the horrible Final Fantasy anthology one.
Oh God, yeah. That was terrible.
Which bad
was
translation.
Like, why burn?
Yeah, I had played 6, I had played 7, and I'm like, all right, I'm going to play 5. What is this? Oh my God, the
so
load
bad.
Times. And of course, the English translation was freaking horrible.
I still adore how Wyvern got turned into Wyburn. That makes my heart sore every time I see it.
No one thought twice about that.
No one did. No one thought at all. I'd be surprised if they thought once. Wyburn. I've actually seen someone did a mock-up of a shirt called like the Wyburns, like a sports logo. I want that shirt so much.
It was only years later that I kind of really came to appreciate Final Fantasy V for what it was.
Mm-hmm, same.
And like how interesting the job system actually was and how it introduced elements like Gilgamesh.
Yeah.
And had a lot of really phenomenal music of its own. But at the time when I played it, I was like, oh my God, this game is so freaking hard.
Yeah.
Because 4 and 6, like 6 in particular, like... You guys were talking about having a lot of trouble with particular areas. I don't recall having any trouble with that game whatsoever.
No, in my case, it was mostly a case of really bad luck.
Mm.
Yeah, in 6, you can kind of... There are a lot of game-breaking items, too, that are not hard to find.
Yeah.
There are lots of ways to tailor your gameplay to make it totally indestructible. Not even just Vanish X Zone, like... Using the two-hand ability and then the
Genji
offering
glove.
Or whatever.
Yeah,
Genji glove and offering. So you do, like, what, 8 attacks per turn?
Yeah, and the Atma weapon. And
I definitely had Genji gloves.
You
yes.
pair that with 2 Atma weapons at full health and you're just,
everything's
like...
Everything's dead. Plus,
yeah, exactly.
The whole Esper system, like, anyone can learn any magic. And
yes,
there's no penalties.
I used Ultima a lot. So
yes.
much Ultima.
Yeah, Gembox and the dual cast relic.
Mm-hmm.
So you get like 2 Ultimas per turn for 1 MP each.
Yeah.
This game needed to be like adjusted a bit, I think. I don't know if they thought like because it's just so easy to break.
Yeah, you've seen Let's Break
Final
Fantasy 6.
At the time. Like God knows Final Fantasy 8 was uber broken as well.
Yeah, so. Oh my God, even more.
Yeah.
But
Final Fantasy 7 as well. So
Final Fantasy 6 its bugs are just legendary. Like have you ever seen the Shadow Empty Party bug? It's the one thing that when I just think about it, I start to laugh because basically there's this bug you can do, and it's very easy to pull off, of course, where you recruit Shadow in the World of Balance, and then you just make him your only party member. And the thing with Shadow is once you fight a certain number of battles, he takes off, right? So you can make it so that he's the only person in your party, and he takes off.
Oh.
And you have this screen playing the battle music. No one's there. It's just going on and on like an asshole. And it's...
The Final Fantasy's over.
The Final Fantasy's over. Goodbye, world ending. Too
go
bad.
Home.
And the
yeah,
best
there's
part,
a great...
And Shadow,
oh, go ahead,
Shadow just, before he leaves, he gives his whole spiel about how I have earned my fee. Goodbye. It's so stupid.
That is stupid. There's also a really good Let's Play on the Let's Play Archive, lparchive.org. I think it's called Let's Break Final Fantasy VI.
That's fantastic. I read
and there's this
thing.
Glitch you can do where you start a new game, you don't save your game, you play up until you get the airship, then you die. Then I believe you spawn with the airship outside of Narsh, or mm-hmm. wherever the first point in the game is. And this is a very broad overview, but it gives you the airship way before you should ever, ever have it.
Yes.
And the game does not know what the hell to do at that point. So there are just so many different ways to just mess with it. Like, having an airship that early, it's insane. Like,
That's,
you have to see this.
I've actually seen that whole LP, and the part that blows my mind most is that somebody made it, this LP made it so that Terra basically conceives herself with her father. Like, you see her sprite in the place of Madeline or whatever her name was, and I'm just like, my mind is broken.
This sounds like fanfic now.
It's totally fanfics. Twisted fanfic, but fanfic nonetheless.
So I'm curious, what did Final Fantasy ultimately mean for the Super Nintendo?
Well, first of all, if nothing else, just how much that sound chip could be pushed to the limit. Because
It's definitely, I think, Uematsu's best, probably like where he peaked as an artist.
Yeah, I agree.
And not that he got a lot worse, but I mean, every artist has their sort of peak performance years where they do their best work. Hopefully mine are still ahead of me. But I feel like he could do no wrong at this point. He was firing on all cylinders, making so much music, operating on like leitmotifs and things like that, which was sort of a new thing for the series. Just very complex musically. And it's funny because the game has sort of like an operatic theme. Obviously there's an opera in the theme, but the characters of Celis and Terra, whose name is Tina, is based on the opera. I believe it's called La Celestina or something Celestina.
Oh, I didn't know
so,
that.
So, yeah, the names of the characters are basically that name of that opera split in half. So they definitely had some operatic ambitions for this story. And it's a very operatic story just with the sheer amount of tragedy involved.
Yeah, there's a little bit of tragedy going on.
Yeah. And also, if you call Terra Tina, I don't know what to think about you. Don't die on that hill.
No, that's a dumb hill to die on. Terra, you probably know the story, how Wolsey wanted something exotic sounding, but Tina is not the name that sounds exotic in English. So
Tina in 1994 would sell you a hot dog on a stick.
Yeah.
She would not be an Esper.
Yeah, so he looked out the window and saw the word Terra, and he said, oh, that's a very good sounding name for like a magical being, and he went with it.
It's a good name.
It is. It's perfect.
And I believe Sabin was Matthew.
Yeah. Or Mash.
So they did change that, yeah. I think that was like just the Japanese transliteration of Matthew. Like Mash. Mashu. Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Oh, okay. What do you know?
With Final Fantasy, at the time, like, there just wasn't a lot of games out there on consoles. I'd like to stress that.
Yes.
That were as intelligent or like as ambitious as an RPG like Final Fantasy. I mean, Fantasy Star 4 and Fantasy Star 2 and 4 were certainly games that came close in a lot of respects. And I'm sure the Fantasy Star defenders will come in and tell you all the ways that Fantasy Star like really stood out in those times. But Final Fantasy, like, man, like, what were we playing at that time, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we were playing Mario Kart, Mario World, and, you know, Mortal Kombat, and
Street Fighter, I think, by that.
Lots of action games, shooters, platformers, and licensed games, like Adam's Family or whatever. there was certainly nothing wrong with that. Like, there were a lot of fantastic games on the Super Nintendo at that time, but, man, Final Fantasy just stood heads and shoulders above so many other games on that console.
Yeah.
There's a reason that. And they've held up incredibly well, right?
I've replayed them.
Like the fact that you can pick them up and play them pretty much any time and go, these are still great games. I mean, melodramatic.
If only we can go back in time and slap the screenplay out of Sakaguchi's hand and say, no, you do not do this. Movies are for movie makers, not you. Go back to Video Game Town. And then you like walk away sadly. But then you know you save Final Fantasy.
Well, maybe the seeds. I'm not saying that Final Fantasy like is dead or that there was actually a demise, but the seeds of its decline were sown in the PlayStation era, where like the focus became a lot more on cutscenes and character designs started taking precedent a little more over like actual well-drawn characters.
Yeah,
is maybe what were kind of the seeds of the series kind of sliding down a little bit. A lot of people will say that, well, I'm not going to get into that, but Final Fantasy, I feel like, was kind of Square's creative peak. And that might have been a case of, I don't know, like art through adversity. Like they had just enough tools at their disposal to be able to create really interesting stuff. but not enough that they could go really freaking bonkers.
Yeah.
And like realize their every kind of cheese ball like fantasy with the console. So we hit like a really happy medium with Final Fantasy and Super Nintendo.
I feel that way too.
I do feel like over time, I feel like Sakaguchi was an important voice in the series, and it's sad that he had to like go away because I did enjoy other things he's done. Like I really liked Last Story?
Yes,
yeah, Last Story.
Yeah, I feel like that could have been an interesting series. It was a little rough mechanically, but I felt like this has sort of that Final Fantasy vibe that I like. And yeah, I hope he does different things than Terra Battle in the future because I don't really care about that.
Terra Battle was actually fun.
We would not still be on Final Fantasy 15 or whatever if Sakaguchi were still on the series.
That's probably true.
Final Fantasy 20 or whatever.
Yes, that is very true. Well, I mean, we wouldn't take a 10-year break for 13. That's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Like he would have gotten those games done, and maybe people would have been like, "Man, these are stale," or maybe not. Maybe he would have continued to grow as a game director.
I would hope so.
Some really interesting stuff. Maybe Last Story would have been Final Fantasy 15, but bigger and more beautiful. And everybody would have been like, wow, Sakaguchi does it again. but he is going to work with the people who did, the Bravely Default series. He's making an RPG with them. So that could be really interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So maybe Sakaguchi will go back to his happy place after being working on Terra Battle and doing the mobile games. So.
Have you seen, by the way, like the pitch video for Terra Battle? I think we talked about this at some point in our lives.
It's like getting his buddies together and getting
drunk on camera agreeing to work on the game. I think that was the plan. Like, I've got you on video saying you're going to work on the game. They wake up hungover the next morning with an email in their inbox like, hey, you're going to work on my game. Video's attached.
Video's attached, yep.
Yeah, it was two years ago.
I said, what?
Yeah, I was at the... I was at the place where he unveiled Terra Battle, and I watched that video live, and I was like,
this is a thing now?
Yeah, but it was, you could see them, like, holding beers and going, yeah, Terra Battle. He was literally got his cell phone camera out and was like, just look at the camera with your beer and say, Terra Battle, yosh. All right, let's go. But Final Fantasy, not much more needs to be said, right? It's such well-covered territory, but there's reason it's been well-covered.
Absolutely.
And that's because, I mean, Final Fantasy 4, 5, and 6, pretty much beyond reproach.
Yeah, I could talk about it all.
Yes, there's probably several thousand hours of me recorded audio of me talking about these games.
Yes.
God knows. But if you have your own thoughts on Final Fantasy, maybe you want to tell us why Final Fantasy on the Super Nintendo is overrated and a different game in the series is much better.
So I can hit you with a stick.
Reach out to me at cat.bailey@usgamer.net or email Nadia and she will show up at your front door with a stick.
Yes, I will. I promise.
Or you can DM me at cat.bailey. I don't think we're going to do a underrated RPG pitch because this episode has already crossed the hour mark. So we will hold that for next week. In the meantime, Axe of the Blood God is a US Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Google Play, and various other outlets. We are a podcast of US Gamer, as I already said. You can reach us or follow me, Cat Bailey, on Twitter at @_CatBot. You can follow Bob at Bob Servo and listen to his podcast, Talking Simpsons. And you can follow Nadia Oxford at Nadia Oxford and go to her site, Tiny Girl, Tiny Games. We're hitting the holiday season at full steam. Mm-hmm. We got a lot of games to play. Dragon Quest VII is just around the corner. Trails of Cold Steel 2 is just around the corner.
I have one thing to mention, Kat. I want people to listen to the Retronauts this week about the Super Nintendo. We do bring up Final Fantasy a few times.
Oh, yes.
And
well,
we
gotta mention Final Fantasy.
This might be our most popular episode ever of the new run, based on like what I'm seeing. So people seem to like it. I hope you guys do too.
Well, it's almost as if people like listening about stuff that they like know a lot about, and
yes,
maybe they'll get a few new nuggets of information, but it's still like a comfortable topic for them.
I do.
It's like, I can listen to them talk about Super Nintendo all day long.
That is true. A strange complaint I get is like, you guys only choose popular topics, but, you know, people want us to talk about those things, so We want to do that.
Yes.
Anything to do with Final Fantasy on this podcast always gets at least 1,000 more downloads.
You wrote that so someone would read it. You fake.
I think you're the fake.
That sounds like clickbait to me.
You made this podcast on purpose.
I was sad that I didn't get to be on the Super Nintendo episode. You guys invited me, but as you
we are feuding, Kat. I don't know if you know this.
Oh, we are? Nobody's
told
me that.
Apparently people thought that we got into a major, almost near fist fight on the Pokemon episode because we playfully cool. disagreed with one another, and I was getting all these messages like, oh my god, you guys really had it out. Like, well,
I think it's because I told you that you were so wrong about Ruby and Sapphire, and that was like, and people were
this
like,
is
oh
how
my god,
Kat and
like
I always
really,
talk.
Really like upset, and I'm like, what? No, I'm just like explaining like why Ruby and Sapphire. Oh, listen to the episode. We got
iTunes reviews about that conversation,
as opposed to actually agreeing all the time.
Yes, it's scary, but we're allowed to disagree.
Yeah, occasionally Bob and I, like, most of the time Bob and I, like, have very similar opinions, especially on, like, retro games. We have similar tastes, so when we, like, actually have differing opinions, it's kind of surprising. So I guess that's why people thought that we were going to get into a fist fight.
I think the Sci-Fi Channel's Lex is way better than Star Trek. That's a lie. That's a lie. I was trying to bait Kat. It's actually Gene Roddenberry's Andromeda. I'm sorry.
That's it. I'm going to fisticuffs tonight over dinner. It's happening. All right. Nadia, do you have anything that you want to promote?
Other than my site, tinygirltinygames.com, I actually recently wrote an article on there about YTMND and how it's particular the peak of its popularity. Well, it kind of chronicled a very unusual time in games history, and I just thought that was a really interesting thing to go over, so I just kind of did a little roundup of that.
And of course, you can find my Fallout 4 Nuka World review on the site when this episode goes up, and you should listen to our flagship podcast, From Us to You, where we talk about World of Warcraft Legion and whether or not Metal Gear Solid 5 holds up. And yes, I know that World of Warcraft Legion is out this week. I wanted to give it a little more time, so we're going to have both Jazz and Mike doing their own segment next week. Until then, I've been Kat Bailey, and for Bob Mackey and Nadia Oxford, thanks for listening. We'll see you again, and happy adventuring.